everybody. Welcome to another episode of the 100 Guitarists podcast. My name is Jason Shadrick.
And I am Nick Milovoy.
And today, episode 3, we are talking about Michael Hedges, the amazing fingerstyle acoustic player that tragically died young. But first, Nick, we want to thank everybody for the response for for the first two episodes.
Overwhelming response we've gotten. A lot of people have reached out.
So we have Andy Summers, we have David Gilmore. Please keep hitting the text or the voicemail line at 319-423-9734. And you can also hit us up at 100guitarists@premierguitar.com.
But we should say we really love voicemails. We'd love to hear people's voices because then we can play them on the podcast. So, you know, we'll read your texts if we can, but leave us a message.
Leave us a message 24/7. The hotline is always open. So today's episode is sponsored by StuMac, and StuMac is hooking you up, saving you a little bit of money. And for the next 10 days, you can get 10% off by clicking the link in the bio down below. Now, Nick, you and I have spent some time with some StuMac products as of late. Sure, we built some pedals. I even shipped a pedal to our gear editor, Charlie Softly, one of those tremolo pedals for him to try out.
Oh, nice. Is it a kit? Is he going to build it?
Yeah, the kit. Mm-hmm. Nice. The same one I did for the one that's actually sitting right over my shoulder.
Oh, there it is.
Yep.
Yeah. I like those red knobs.
Head on over to StuMac.com, get some tools, get some anything you need to fix up a guitar, build a pedal, fix up a pedal. Head on over to StuMac.com and check it out. And thank you, StuMac, for the support.
All right, Jason. So, Michael Hedges. You know, I think that, you know, we talked about this a little bit. Our first two episodes, Andy Summers from The Police, mm-hmm. David Gilmore from Pink Floyd. These are people, everybody knows who they are. Michael Hedges might be a little bit more of a guitarist for guitarists, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thinking about it, as I said that, everybody I know who listens to Michael Hedges is a guitar player. So, a little bit for the head. So, if you're not familiar with Michael Hedges, or if you are and you need a little catching up, Michael Hedges played almost exclusively, but not totally exclusively, acoustic guitar. He started his career mostly playing instrumental music, but he did sing a lot over the course of his career. His compositions are really technically oriented. He did a lot of two-handed tapping, and he'd play weird instruments, namely harp guitars. And, between that and between the harp guitar and the tapping, it's like he could play and sound like three different guitar players playing at the same time. And that's sort of like that's the big thing I think that people talk about when they talk about Michael Hedges is like,
I think the tapping and then stuff. The tapping and then just the sheer amount of tunings he used.
Yes.
Like maybe, I mean, on like Joni Mitchell level number of tunings.
Yeah.
You know, so, and we're going to talk about that more in a little bit.
They're all over the place. Open tune, like open chord tunings, a lot of dadgad based stuff. And then of course, you know, the extra strings of the harp guitars get crazy too. But you know, Michael Hedges spent his career starting with 1981's Breakfast in the Field was his first record. Starting there, he was on Windham Hill Records for his entire discography. Windham Hill is like most known as a new age label, so that he ended up having a new age, being, you know, labeled as a new age musician, which, you know, we can also get into that a little bit. I think that label is very fitting for some of his music, and maybe it's not as fitting for other parts of his music, or at least like maybe at the time it was, but I don't know that now. I think now a lot of people make music that sounds like Michael Hedges, and it's not considered new age. Hedges died in 1997 at the age of 43, tragically in a car accident. When he'd perform, he had a very physical style of performing. He'd do all sorts of, you can watch videos, and he's, you know, he dances a lot while he plays, which I feel like, you know, you think about acoustic guitar guy, especially somebody playing mostly instrumental stuff. You think of somebody like sitting up on stage, and that is commonly the vibe, not Michael Hedges. he danced around on stage a lot. He did a lot of like, I don't know enough about yoga to really talk about this. I know he was really into yoga, but I think he did yoga moves, or at least yoga inspired moves while he was playing. But it's not just a show. That also is like a big part of the music. Like, cause he would hit his guitar, like his percussive accompaniment. And I think that that's all related to this like physical thing that he would do. And it just, you know, we'll talk about some videos, and definitely like, if you're listening to this, check out videos of Head just playing, because it's like, it's such a part of like the aesthetic. And I think before YouTube existed, when I only heard the records, I didn't really understand Michael Hedges until I saw videos of him playing. Like, oh, this guy's like not just this serious guy. He's funny too.
Have you seen the video of him at Red Rocks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's like, can you imagine like solo acoustic guitar player playing Red Rocks?
Yeah.
You know, and doing his music, like I said, it was so physical and it was so like aggressive. Like that's where I struggle with like the new age.
Exactly.
The new age label, because he has some songs and some compositions that are like incredibly beautiful and kind of fit right in there. But, and I know they have, you know, they got to put him in some bin in the Sam Goody, you know, they got to put him somewhere. Or they had to put him somewhere for Grammy nominations, you know, but
of which he had a couple,
and as did Pat Metheny, also new age winner. But I just feel like to introduce somebody to that type of music, like I feel like you need to put the new age thing aside.
Yeah.
You know, even his label mates on like Wyndham Hill, like just put that aside. Michael is kind of like his own thing.
He mostly played solo, but he did play with Michael Manring, the bassist Michael Manring, a lot.
Yeah.
They were like, they were a very tight duo. There's stuff where I think it's like easy to not even think about the two of them, like not even think about the music being played by a duo. It sounds like solo music almost, the way that like Manring and Hedges are like so looped in. Something cool that I have thought was cool is that David Crosby and Graham Nash also collaborated with Michael a lot. I think
that's one thing I'd forgotten. I remember checking out that Taproot album after he had passed or Torched, where they were both released after he passed away. I think
Torched is the one you're thinking of, because they got involved and helped finish it.
That's right.
And he had opened for CSN, which is also kind of crazy for a solo acoustic dude.
Just go out there and blow people's minds, and then the cats can come up and sing some harmonies.
If he wasn't new age music, like what was he?
I mean, like if he were to come out today, which is kind of weird, because he was really, to me, him and Pierre Bensoussan were kind of the first to really usher in like what we kind of know as modern acoustic, like with Andy McKees and Mike Dawes and Yasmin Williams and all these new generations of acoustic guitar players. I mean, I think he would just be called acoustic music. I don't even know if they would have to like put some kind of like subgenre label on it. But, you know, back when he was putting out records, you kind of had to have, you got to call it something. You had to put it, you know, you had to put the CD somewhere in the bin, like I said,
or the record,
right. So,
yeah, I think the thing about his sound, when I think about it in the time, I mean, 1981 is pretty early for the way he sounded, that like, you know, when I think of other acoustic music at that time, I'm thinking about like Leo Kottke or John Fahey, and those are players who are playing in this like sort of Americana-y kind of vibe. Whereas like somebody like Joni Mitchell is not an acoustic, like a solo acoustic person. Joni Mitchell is like, you know, primarily, you know,
a singer-songwriter,
right?
Yeah.
But it's like she is more in line with like what Michael was doing acoustically than like those other guys maybe. Even though like, yeah, they were, you know, he was in that world, but of the other acoustic players, but it's like Joni's sort of tuning, like the tuning thing, and just bigger than the tuning thing and related to the tuning thing is just like the harmony. Like he is not playing Americana music.
No, he's not. And he's not even dealing with like, I mean, yeah, he's using the 12 notes that we all are, but as we'll see when we go through maybe some of these, when we play the Michael Hedges tuning game, that sometimes you're like, how, you just wonder, like, some of these tunings had to be driven purely by sound.
Yeah.
You know, purely by like, oh, well, that sounds funny. Or I can play an interesting chord with some open strings simply because of that tuning, you know.
Yeah.
Or it lends itself to maybe an interesting tapping part because you might have octaves within the tuning. So
that's the thing that I was thinking about is like, you know, there's like, even though he's just one person playing this stuff, I think of Michael Hedges, like listening to it now, I had never thought about it until we were preparing for this episode that like, he's kind of also in the same world as like minimalist composers, like, you know, like Philip Glass or Steve Reich or something, where like his harmony is like that kind of harmony. And the tuning thing is like how to be multiple guitars, like minimalism is often layers of parts on top of each other. So it's like the tunings are a way to accomplish that or something. And that's, I never thought about that before. You know, and you mentioned Pat Metheny recorded, Steve Reich's Electric Counterpoint. And I feel like I could hear that in some of the Hedges tunes, like that kind of thing with the tapping and this subtlety and the dynamics. So
let's get some calls.
Yeah. Perfect. All right, so the first call we got is, we got a lot of calls for this one. I was pretty blown away at how many people reached out about Michael Hedges. The first one, we got.
You could say we probably got more calls for this than any episode we've done so far.
Put together,
that's right, that's right.
Yeah. So we're on to something. Keep it up, guys.
Yes.
Guitarist, singer, songwriter Buck Kuring hit us up. He's a solo artist. He's also in the duo Arborea, and he also is a writer. He's written for Acoustic Guitar Magazine. He wrote a piece about Michael Hedges' Dubourg acoustic guitar for Acoustic Guitar Magazine. And here's what Buck had to say.
The first time I found out about Michael Hedges was from the cover story of Guitar Player magazine when Michael had released his album Taproot in 1990. The opening track, The Naked Stock, completely blew me away. The haunting melody, the timbre and dynamics, and the space between his notes, everything was just so perfect. That album quickly led to listening to his other albums, Aerial Boundaries, Breakfast in the Field, and Live on the Double Planet. In particular, the tracks Spare Change, Ben Suzan, and Ragamuffin from Aerial Boundaries inspired my own playing early on. If you listen closely to my instrumental Song for Liam, you can hear his influence, especially in the way I play the melodic notes of the primary melody and the use of legato. I think another important thing about Michael's music is that it creates incredibly vivid and beautiful soundscapes. His album, Breakfast in the Field, was always a favorite soundtrack for drives with my family through the forests of Maine and over to the coast. I'll never forget one particular drive in autumn. The leaves were falling off the trees and swirling in the air, and we were listening to his instrumental, The Happy Couple. The notes seemed to dance perfectly with the movement of the leaves, and time seemed to just stand still. As it pertains to composing music for the acoustic guitar, Michael Hedges is definitely among the most significant.
I mean, that sort of paints us a picture right there of like what Michael Hedges' music kind of sounds like, right?
Totally, yeah. Thanks, so, Buck.
Thank you, Buck. Now to contrast musically, to talk about, to sort of set us up to talk about Michael's influence. Here's a very different guitar player. Kevin Hufnagel is the guitar player in the bands Gorguts, Veldun, and Dysrhythmia. And if you know those bands...
Now, to be clear, those are three separate bands, because that would be a good band name, just all three of them together. But those are three separate bands.
The least spellable band name ever. Yeah, so it's like Kevin also does some acoustic music and some solo guitar music, and I've always sensed that there was some Michael Hedges in there, so I was happy that he called in. Here's what Kevin had to say.
I consider Michael to be one of the most important guitarists ever, certainly one of the most influential on me as a player. Everything from his use of alternative tunings and harmonics to his control over dynamics and timbre was all huge for me as a player. I had never thought about radically retuning my guitar any differently until after I heard his music. That was hugely inspiring. It became an enormous part of how I actually composed music. You know, after seeing the possibilities, you know, that he displayed. His albums are something I can put on at any time of day, regardless of what kind of mood I'm in. They all have this healing quality and comfort to them that I think reflected his soul. One of my biggest regrets is never seeing him live. I vividly remember the day I heard of his passing, and you know, I was crushed, and immediately a song came out, you know, that I eventually dedicated to him, and came out of me, you know, something I wrote. And yeah, his work touched me deeply, and still does.
So something Kevin said there, thank you, Kevin, by the way. Something Kevin said leads us nicely into just talking about why Michael Hedges matters, why his influence matters mm-hmm. on guitar players, which is, you know, Kevin mentioned that Michael Hedges' music is like how he got into alternate tunings. And that was the same for me. I started listening to Michael Hedges as a teenager. And when I heard that, I was into acoustic guitar playing. And when I heard his stuff, I just like, it didn't make any sense to me, like how you could do this on the same instrument that I was holding. And I just got into researching what his tunings were and exploring tunings. And I don't know. Yeah, nothing. I had heard some alternate tunings before that, but nothing struck me in the same way where I like had to go figure it out, you know?
Yeah, I think I was kind of the same way. The first time I heard of Michael Hedges was when my guitar, I went in my guitar lesson and he told me that Michael Hedges had died. And again, I thought it was like a relative or something, like real uh-huh. sorry. And it's like, no. And then he played Aerial Boundaries for me like in the lesson. And I'm like, oh, wow. I didn't even know. And again, I'm, you know, 14 years old, wanting to play Green Day songs. And Mark, my teacher, was like, no, you got to check this out. And he played Aerial Boundaries for me. I was like, wow, that's really cool. And then he kind of showed me a little bit of what the type of things I was hearing. You know, it's an alter tuning. He's doing some of this tapping stuff, you know, that kind of thing. But that, you know, Michael Hedges is kind of player, like, was inspiring to me, but I was never like, holy cow, let me start twisting the tuning pegs on my guitar. You know, that just seemed like such a different world for me that other than drop D and maybe dad gad, I didn't really mess with tuning so much because maybe like you, I'm working so hard just in standard tuning. Yeah. I'm working hard in standard tuning at that time, still am a little bit, I guess, that thinking of, oh, we're going to have, this is going to be the tuning, would just like, it would take all of my, you know, roadmaps away, which could be freeing and inspiring in a way. But I can definitely sense that Michael Hedges' music was probably very influential to a lot of musicians whose music sounds nothing like Michael Hedges. You know?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the very thing that kept you away from exploring those tunings is what got me into exploring those tunings, which was like, maybe if I find a different tuning, I'll be a little bit better. Yeah. I'll find something that clicks a little bit more. This is how I'll be different from my friends.
It was all altered tunings and transparent overdrives for you, because that any overdrive with three knobs is guaranteed to make you better.
Like, dude. I know.
Without a doubt.
Don't I know it? Without a doubt. As we were assembling notes for this and we were putting this episode together, a guy named Andrew Gorney reached out to me. He saw my post on Instagram asking for you know, contributions. And it turns out Andrew Gorney has an Instagram page. He you can look him up. His last name is spelled Gorny. He plays a lot of Michael Hedges tunes. He talks a lot about Michael Hedges inspired stuff. And, you know, there's stuff about him up on the official michaelhedges.com website. And, he was a great source for getting us in touch with folks. And, Andrew, you know, I ended up checking out a bunch of his stuff. He really is a legit, like, source of Michael Hedges' knowledge. But he called and gave a holler, and this was an excerpt of what he had to say.
The process of learning his music is kind of the gift that really kind of keeps on giving. There's so many technical details in his compositions, of course, like, you know, all the things he pioneered with left and right hand techniques that, you know, we pretty much see all over Instagram now. And I think every solo guitarist should spend several years studying his work. Just really incredible. Just like how classical guitarists study Fernandesor Francisco Torrega.
Yeah, I can get with that, right?
Like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Learn to.
I mean, he created, you know, he invented and created this vocabulary that, like he said, anytime you scroll through Instagram and see a modern acoustic guitar player, you know, a lot of what they're building their sound on was started by Michael Hedges and Pierre Bensoussan.
Yeah. All right, so we got another call. This is from a guy named Jake White. Jake White is Michael Hedges' official biographer. He's working on a book. He's been working on it since 2019. And he says it's almost finished. Apparently, he's done like hundreds of interviews for this. He's interviewed the Hedges family, all of Michael's collaborators and friends, and the family is supportive. And his book is titled Dream Out Loud. You can find out more about it at dreamoutloudbook.com. And he let us know also, it's not in this message we're going to play, but he let us know that the Hedges family are playing a documentary, or planning a documentary. Mm-hmm. And there's some info about that at michaelhedges.com. And we'll give some information for how to find out more at the end. But here's what Jake had to say.
Michael Hedges was an incredible musician and composer who essentially created several new ways to play the guitar. And he was also instrumental in reviving the harp guitar, this sort of bygone instrument that had essentially disappeared after the 1930s until Hedges started performing with it in the early 1980s. He also made important contributions in songwriting and extensive guitar tunings, live guitar sound and performance, and unique cover tunes, and just certainly had a distinctive approach to composition. Virtually everyone you see on YouTube who are using alternate guitar tunings or slapping and tapping and percussion on the guitar, they've been influenced directly or indirectly by Michael Hedges.
All right, yeah. We agree with that. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Jake. Thanks for calling, and I'm stoked to check out that book.
Yeah, and the documentary
stuff in there. Yeah. So, do you have any favorite Michael Hedges songs?
Yes, and we put all my favorites on the official 100 Guitarists Michael Hedges playlist, which again is linked below. But I would say most of them, the album I keep coming back to is Live on the Double Planet.
Oh, yeah. That's my favorite one.
The Double Planet live record. And that to me is the most complete view of what he does.
Yeah.
You know, Life on the Double Planet. It has, you know, his hits, so to speak, Breakfast in the Field, you know, Ricky Shuffle, and his covers like All Along the Watchtower and Come Together, has your Funky Avocado in there. That to me, most of the stuff on there is really good. As far as like tunes, I mean, Aerial Boundaries was the one, Ragamuffin from that first record, that was also very interesting. And then the Oracle record, which was the last one he finished with Jitter Boogie and Oracle, also has a Zappa cover, Sofa Number One.
Oh, that's right. That's so good.
You know?
Yeah.
So I would say between those three records, the live one, Aerial Boundaries, and Oracle, those to me are pretty, not only cover a lot of pretty much all the eras of his career, but they basically give you everything you need to know about Michael Hedges.
For me, the song Because It's There, which is on Live at the Double Planet, that one, I remember, like, I would listen to that when I was like trying to figure this stuff out a little bit briefly. I would listen to that and just try and try and imagine, this was pre-YouTube, I didn't know what it really looked like. I had never seen a video of him playing. Just try and imagine like what he's doing with each hand and how he's playing those harp guitar parts. To me, that is like such a great example of like these interlocking parts, and I could just never figure out how one person could play that song.
And now I looked at, did he use looping a lot? Because I know when we get to the gear part, I remember seeing a looper in his setup, but it seems like sometimes when I'll listen to his music, I'm like, is that a loop, or is he literally just playing all the parts at the same time? You know,
he's just playing all the parts at the same time, which is crazy. Like, and especially thinking about it now, like, I mean, Double Planet was 1987, so it's like that wasn't looping, live looping wasn't really like an easy proposition at that point.
Yeah.
So it was easier to perform it live, but it's like, it's interesting now that there's looper, you know, you have loopers, I have looper, you know, everybody has access to various ways to loop things. Would people even write music that is like that? That is that actually that complicated and that hard to do? Like, you could just loop it and it would sound the same. I don't know. It's kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
Two tracks that I sort of rediscovered. I had heard them before, but I never really caught my ear the same way until recently. The songs Point A and Point B from Taproot. Do you know these tunes? He plays he's playing a trans trem guitar. I think it's a Klein. He had this this, you know, Klein headless electric guitar that was a harp guitar also with a trans trem system. Those sound still like music from the future to me. Like what he's doing with the vibrato on those tunes, it's so hard to explain because I would have to sit and watch him play that and really dissect it to really figure out what's going on there. But like the way that he bends between chords and it's awesome. It sounds different. It's different techniques than other songs of his. And it's different really from like, I don't know, maybe any guitar player. Like they're so interesting. So those will be on the playlist too. But check those songs out.
All right. We talked about a bunch of cover songs. We might've already answered this, but what's your favorite Michael Hedges cover song?
I bounced between this a little bit because I do think so many of them are so good, but I think like, for me, the one I think of that's like the most iconic is his version of All Along the Watchtower, which is the first track on Live on the Double Planet.
Yeah. Yeah. That, and he sings it, you know, he doesn't do it instrumentally. It's funny that in my life, that song has been a gateway into several people's discography, most notably Michael Hedges and Dave Matthews.
Yeah. Very different versions.
Very different versions, but I didn't, by the time I got around to Michael Hedges, I knew it was a cover, but did not think it was, I thought it was a Dave Matthews original when I first heard it. awesome. So yeah, I would say that. I'd say Sofa Number One, After the Gold Rush, which I thought you were going to say was going to be your favorite.
Surprise.
Yeah, I would say those stick out to me.
I really love his version of Sheila E.'s Love Bizarre.
Oh,
yeah. Also on Live on the Double Planet, but I feel like that's a little bit like, that can't be my favorite one. Like All Along the Watchtower is more like, captures more about like what he is all about versus like Love Bizarre is just like a fun little thing, but I love it. That's a great example of his singing. He's an amazing singer. He does all that falsetto stuff on that song. It's unbelievable.
All right. We're going to play a quick game.
Hit me.
We're going to play... I would say guess the tuning, but there's no way you would
ever.
There's
no way.
There's no way. But there are a couple places online where are like databases for all the tunings that Michael, all the alternate tunings that Michael used. Mm-hmm. And some of these were very interesting. And one here, the tune's The Happy Couple is the name of the tune. Mm-hmm. The tuning is G from low to high. I'm assuming here. Yeah, I would imagine these are written low to high. G, B, E, F sharp, A, D.
Whoa.
So how would you come up with that? You have a D major triad on the top three strings.
Yeah.
And you have...
I guess you're going he's going up to a G on the sixth string.
Yes, probably.
And then up to a B.
Up to a B, up to an E.
Yeah.
Then down to F sharp, down to A, down to D.
So I found there's a video we'll put in the notes where he talks about like getting to his tunings and how he just like he lets the music lead him there, which it's like, I get that, you know, you're experimenting. You're like, I need this note and it's not here. Let me tune the string. Cool. I'm all there. How do you get to that tuning? Right. Like,
right.
I would never tune my sixth string from E up to G.
The interesting thing about this tuning is, so you have D major triad on the top three, E minor triad on the bottom three.
Yeah.
But they're in the same inversion.
Oh, I didn't think
so. That. Third, 3-5-1 on the low strings, 3-5-1 on the top strings. Like that to me, like, and I just kind of picked this tuning at random. That tuning to me, like, I can see the utility in that because
yeah,
if you basically kind of have two open tunings that you're putting together, you have a D major open tuning and E minor open tuning that you're then putting together. And that to me, I can kind of wrap my head around and understand, you know, how to maybe make some chord shapes.
And also like the two hand tapping thing, it's like, it's probably, you know, one hand's getting three strings, the other hand's getting three strings. So it's
exactly
like two different universes. So they don't need to be, they can be different triads. Exactly. Give me one more. Yep. Let's do one more.
All right. Here's, I'm going to go really random here.
Let's do every tuning.
Okay, here's one. No, that's too easy. Okay, D A E F A E.
Oh, okay.
So low to high D. So you're tuning down to D, keep the A,
and then up to E.
Up to E, down to F, down to A, and you leave the top E string the same. So
it's kind of like this D sus 2 on the bottom strings.
D minor.
What was it? D?
You have the
D
F.
A E?
D A E on the low strings.
Oh, but then on the top, then that makes it a minor. Yeah.
The F and the E is what really throws me off there because two open strings are half step apart, basically.
Yeah. I like that though. What song is that?
Oracle. That one's off Oracle. Pinball Wizard. I got to check out that. That's off the Strings of Steel record.
Okay.
Low to high. B, F sharp, C sharp, E, A, A. So the top two strings are tuned to A.
Double A.
Double A on top. E in the middle. And low strings are B, F sharp, C sharp. So again, no real like overarching, like what we talked about with that first tuning.
But I love the B, F sharp, C sharp. You get that. That's like an Andy Summers chord right there.
Yeah,
right?
It's like an open Andy Summers thing.
That's hip.
He's like, I don't want to fret that. I'm just going to tune it. I'm just going to tune it to it.
Yeah, again, I've played some weird tunings. I've written tunes and in weird tunings and all. I've never gone there.
I feel like him and Joni have literally just invented hundreds of tunings. Hundreds of tunings.
Man, it's so inspiring.
You know? Awesome. All right, let's keep it moving. So we touched a little bit on gear stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, his main guitar was just a 71 Martin D28, right?
Yeah, Barbara.
Barbara, named Barbara.
Yeah, he had another Martin too, but that was that's the main one he played.
That's the main one. And he also had a Ken DeBorg custom. Yep.
And that one he used on the first record, and there's a video we can put that in the notes too, where he talks about it was stolen after the first record and it didn't come back to him, but it did come back to him years later. It was in pieces. He had to get it restored, but that, like, he clearly was very fond of that guitar.
We have a Peter Frampton situation is what you're saying.
He had a couple different harp guitars. I think they're, you know, you can see pictures of a couple of them, but I think the main one he used was a 1920s Dyer, that he would schlep around this old guitar, this giant old guitar.
Hold on. This is kind of crossing my mind here as somebody who's done some rig rundowns and has some interaction with guitar techs. Bro has a ton of tunings. So I don't even know if he would even tour with a guitar tech, but how many guitars would you have to he had to bring multiple guitars on the road.
Oh, he had to bring, yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying you bring 10, because I remember I did the Lindsey Buckingham rig rundown. I bet he had 15 of those Turners.
Whoa.
For a solo. I mean, like a whole boat of those Turner
identical guitars. Ones.
Visually, yeah. Visually, I mean, I'm sure some of them were in some, I mean, everything had a backup, so that's probably why, but you got to think, I mean, is he literally just tuning, and which wouldn't surprise me at all if he's like, no, I have the 71 Martin and I have the backup and I'm just in between songs, I'm just tuning it up and moving along. Like that yeah. wouldn't surprise me at all, but I feel like in modern days, people are like, let me bring 3-4 acoustics. And at least have them living in, because some of these tunings are higher tension, like you're tuning strings up, and some of them will yeah. go down, like you said, like down to B. So I would think you might need a different string setup.
Yeah.
At least I would.
Some of those tunings totally need different strings.
Yeah.
And so the website nomadland.com, that's what we use for our gear research. They have everything listed there. And there are other guitars, like there is another Martin, there's a Takamine that he used, like, there are a handful of guitars, but even with that, it's like you're saying, the practical limitations of like what he's traveling with and like how it all makes sense to like fit all these tunings in. Yeah. That's something that like watching videos on YouTube can capture, but like really it's like you'd have to see him and know what was going on to really understand the behind yeah. the scenes of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, okay. So there was also that Klein harp guitar that I mentioned. But something that I am fascinated by is like his sound on the acoustic is like, and this is like going back to the 80s and 90s, like his live acoustic sound was so much better than like, it's just phenomenal. It's like so much better than so many players you see today. Like, I don't know. I feel like he had more limited resources than we have now and yet did so much with like the way an acoustic guitar sounds live.
Yeah.
And so from what I can tell, from what I found, he used like two effects, which was a TC Electronics 1140 parametric EQ and preamp, and then the TC Electronics 1210 spatial expander. And then on the harp guitar, he used the TC Electronics SCF stereo chorus pitch modulator flanger 7. Pretty simple setup, like not crazy pedal board, not, you know, there's other stuff. He used, you know, some DI stuff, but that's like most, you know, I'm just sort of editing out to like what gives him like that sound that like as soon as you listen to Michael Hedges, you'll hear what I'm talking about. But like, mm-hmm. it's so, I don't know, it's just like so different than the way people approach their live acoustic guitar setup today.
Right. All right. Fake award time. We got to give Michael a fake award. You're up.
Best tapper, parentheses, acoustic division.
See, that's very close to my thought was mine was the EVH Acoustic Pioneer Award, right? Because he literally invented a style of acoustic playing, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was basically a contemporary of Eddie.
Oh, yeah.
In age or whatever. And in every acoustic player after Michael, unless you're more the strummy acoustic singer-songwriter type. He influenced everybody after him. You know, there's just basically, even though Pierre was a hero of Michael's, there's basically before Michael and after Michael. And after Michael is where we're, and even just now we're really starting to see the next two generations or so after Michael come through and you know, pay homage to him, either just in style or just, you know, creating an entire career off his influence, which is great.
Yeah. All right, so we got Randy from Pittsburgh. Here's what Randy had to say.
He was a dear friend of mine. I know every time he would come to Pittsburgh, we would get together and get a chance to catch up, and it was always an evening I was always looking forward to. You never knew what Michael was going to bring to the table or what he was going to be into. Very interesting individual. musically, you know, how many people have taken what he was doing at that time and incorporated anything about Khaki King or even someone like Tommy Emmanuel. I would say Mike was first and foremost really a composer, very rhythm-oriented. Like I said, just a lot of good stories. I miss my friend. He was quite a character. Anyway, enjoying the podcast. Hope everything's well on your side.
All right. Thank you, Randy. Glad you're digging the podcast.
So our last call here is from Brett Boyer. He's an old friend. We used to do a bunch of guitar workshops across the country in my pre-Premier Guitar days. He's based out of Austin, Texas. He's an incredible songwriter and fingerstyle player. And he got to see, as he'll describe, he got to see Michael Hedges a couple times when he was living in Kansas.
'80s. I saw him play twice in concert in the late 80s and the early 90s, both at Liberty Hall in Lawrence, Kansas. At the time, I had Aerial Boundaries and Breakfast in the Fields. I had those two records, and I loved them. I thought they were great. And so I was expecting that. And when I got there, it was just so much more energy in that than those records. Those records were great, and I still love those records, but his live performance was just so much more. And I think that was one of the things about Michael that was prevalent throughout his career, is he always seemed to be giving you more than you expected. Whatever you expected, he surpassed that with his concerts. And it was just so amazing. And besides his repertoire, which included, you know, the first time he was doing Come Together, and I heard an AC/DC song, and later Fine Young Cannibals tunes, as well as all of his original music. So his repertoire was just full of energy. And as cool as that was, his sound was just so huge and present, and it just filled that hall. And at the time, you know, I didn't know anybody else that was using multiple pickups on their acoustic guitar. And he had this amazing big sound that was really present. And it all added up to something that was just so different and so powerful. And I think that, you know, that kind of is a part of who he was. He wasn't like Clark Kent and Superman. He was always Superman. I think he just walked around being a different kind of person, and his music and the way he played the guitar represented that. But I think he was kind of always that. I was lucky enough to know a couple people that grew up with him, and they kind of reinforced that he was always a different type of person, and led to one of the most amazing guitar players. And he brought so much music to all of us that we get to just keep listening to, and he brought so much music to the world that anyway, if you didn't get a chance to see him live, I hope you'll check out his recordings. And I think he started something that you can see the ripples of in almost all acoustic guitar players today.
All right, and we got one more message, and that was from Misha Hedges, who is Michael's son. He reached out to let us know. He just wanted to let us know everything that they were up to, which was the Jake White book, and also the documentary. That's something that he and Michael's brother, Misha's uncle, Brendan, have been working on. And he just wanted to say they're currently in production. They've raised about a third of their total budget. And he says, we're currently raising funding to complete production and edit the film. We expect to finish the film in 2025 if the fundraising goes well. More info, our fundraising trailer, and a full video update about the film can be found at michaelhedges.com/2024-year-end. And we'll put that link in the notes too.
Yeah.
And I'll just add that the michaelhedges.com site that they manage is like a totally huge resource on Michael Hedges stuff. So head over there, check that out. Send them some cash if you can.
There we go. All right. Well, we covered it for this week. So please let us know what you think. You can email us at 100-100-GUITARISTS@premierguitar.com. And like we mentioned, you can text or call and leave a voicemail at 319-423-9734. And who are we talking about next week, Nick?
Next week, we're talking about George Benson.
All-time great. We've both interviewed him fairly recently. So
that'll be a fun one.
We'll have some new news.
We'll be right back.